regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We are not going to be talking about the shooting in Minneapolis yesterday, although there is certainly plenty to talk about. This is following the standard script for the gun control groups, a high-profile shooting. They immediately launch into unnamed calls for gun control, right? We didn't hear necessarily specific calls for bans on so-called assault weapons or red flag laws. They'll wait until they can, make their argument fit the circumstances of the crime before they call for specific policies. Now, of course, we are starting to see the calls for bans on so-called assault weapons and the like. But, you look at the circumstances of this. This is an individual who clearly deeply disturbed. We don't know what kind of warnings he might have given beforehand, but pretty clearly a deeply disturbed individual. But also apparently no previous criminal record, no prior contact with law enforcement, no adjudication of mental illness. I keep hearing people say, well, what if we had a red flag law? Well, what if we had a red flag law? Would one have even been used? Because Minnesota has a civil commitment law that apparently wasn't put in place. So did anybody believe that this individual was a danger to themselves or others beforehand? Now, obviously, looking at this individual's manifesto, it's pretty clear that, yeah, they were. But again, is the issue take this individual's guns away and then the problem is solved? Because it sounds to me like this individual is so twisted that even if you had a red flag law in place, and even if that red flag law was deployed against this individual, they would have used a knife, they would have used their car, they would have used something else to commit an act of mass murder, because that was their intent. I think there's a broader discussion to be had about this subculture that glorifies and idolizes mass killers, but that's going to be a topic for another time. On today's program, we're going to be talking with Joe Laporto from the New Jersey Firearms Owner Syndicate about the ongoing efforts in the Garden State to give concealed carry applicants some of their money back. In response to the Bruin decision a couple of years ago, New Jersey changed its concealed carry laws, increasing, among other things, increasing the cost to apply for a concealed carry permit. Of this $200 fee, $150 is supposed to go to the municipality where the applicant lives. And we talked with Elizabethtown Borough Mayor Dana Francisco, who was the first in the state to call for refunding that portion of the application fee to local residents. Englishtown Borough did, in fact, do that. They've been joined by almost a half dozen other communities around the Garden State. Unfortunately, we have also seen at least one community vote down this proposal to give gun owners their money back. And the council members argue, well, I mean, you got to pay fees for all kinds of stuff. So, why not? And I don't think $200 is unreasonable to exercise a fundamental right. Joe Laporto, again, with the New Jersey Firearms Owner Syndicate, has been very instrumental in getting these communities to adopt these resolutions. And thought it'd be a good time to talk with Joe about what has happened to date and maybe what is on tap for the future. So take a look and a listen. Joe, thanks for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir. Good to meet you virtually.
Yeah, good to finally meet you too. I know our mutual friend John Petrolino has been working hard to make this happen, and I want to thank him for coordinating this. And of course, it's a real pleasure and an honor to be here with you today.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, big thanks to John, but it's also a real pleasure to talk with you because you are doing incredible work there in New Jersey, and this is a tough fight. I mean, it's a tough area to be a Second Amendment activist, but you guys have been making some real significant progress. I mean, talking about, reducing these concealed carry fees, refunding the people's money back to them, right? That's tough to get government to give up money in any circumstance, right?
Yeah.
But particularly when we're talking about money related to our right to keep and bear arms in a state that makes it incredibly difficult to exercise that right. The fact that you've been able to get, about a half dozen communities across New Jersey to issue these refunds in what, like a little over a month, right?
That's correct. I mean, we've been sort of all gas, no brakes on this. I think some context is sort of warranted here. They always say that politics is about the art of the possible, right? And so we as an organization, you know, we have been around for quite some time. Mark Cheesman, J-Factor, our founders, they started this initiative as sort of like a pure grassroots effort, you know, more than 10 years ago. And just in the last year, we have evolved into, you know, an official, you know, incorporated as a nonprofit in the state of New Jersey and now officially open for business in just the last, you know, sort of 10 months or so. And it's been, you know, it's been a heck of a freshman year for us. I mean, in just this last 10 months, I mean, we've sued the government twice. You know, we have been a voice for gun owners in Trenton on a number of gun control bills that have been moving through this session. You know, we have introduced legislation in Trenton, you know, and now we are working at all levels of government. And this permitting fee project is a pretty exciting initiative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Again, like what can we achieve in a state like New Jersey? You know, that's our goal is obviously twofold. You know, we're going to fight for gun rights in court, but, you know, to the extent that we can make ground in, you know, through the stroke of a pen, through legislative initiatives, we're going to try to explore and exploit every single one of those opportunities. But, you know, in a deep blue state, well, I shouldn't say that. I personally think New Jersey is a shifting landscape, and we'll see what happens in this election. And we've certainly been putting a ton of effort into getting out the vote as far as gun owners and getting their voices on the record this fall in the state election. But, you know, so we'll see. I think New Jersey's a work in progress, but at least as far as the composition in Trenton is concerned, there's really limited opportunity here. So we're not going to get consensus on important issues, you know, that affect gun owners in the state, you know, standard capacity magazine bans and assault weapon bans, those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, there should be consensus on some basic concepts. And one of those should be that, you know, hiding core constitutional rights behind a cost prohibitive paywall should be offensive to everyone. These are discriminatory practices that I don't care what your stripe is, Democrat, Republican. You know, we have in other contexts in this country, we have universally rejected these kinds of policies. And so, you know, we have a kind of unique situation where these municipalities, they didn't set the fees based on their own understanding of what their administrative costs are, what they think is fair or right. They were just told what to do by the state. And so this is, you could look at this as yet another sort of state mandate that comes down to the municipal level, and they're just sort of forced to follow along, whether they like it or not. Well, here's a clear opportunity for towns to both support the Second Amendment and reject discriminatory practices. And we're finding that there is excitement around this initiative on that basis alone.
And, you know, listen, I mean, I'm sure you're going to have a more of an uphill climb in Democrat-dominated cities. But as you say, you know, look, frankly, even if you don't like the right to carry, it's a right that's recognized by the state of New Jersey, right? So then the issue becomes, do you want to use the power of the government to, as you say, impose such a financial burden on people that they can't exercise a right, even if it's one you don't like? Because once you say yes to that, I mean, you know, Joe, that puts you in some pretty bad company, right? That puts you in with the poll tax Democrats, that puts you in with the Jim Crow Democrats. And I don't think that, you know, a lot of New Jersey politicians really want to be compared accurately to those types of politicians. So, you know, I think that you're right that at least in theory, there should be an issue that has the ability to cross partisan lines. It seems like most of the towns, if not all of the towns that you guys have started with, though, have been Republican dominated, or at least Republican leaning in terms of the makeup of their town council or borough council, right?
Yeah, I mean, almost universally, at least as a starting point. I mean,
right.
Look, where are we going to go with this first? We're going to go to towns where there's at least a consensus amongst local government that protecting constitutional rights is important. And we're not going to, unfortunately, get that kind of like early enthusiasm in all Democrat controlled cities and towns. So,
yeah.
You know, we have to start with the quote unquote low hanging fruit. And, you know, again, you know, from their point of view, look, this should be a relatively straightforward, you know, decision for many of these municipalities. Some of them are larger, you know, but for many of these municipalities, the number of permits that are sort of outstanding in their towns is relatively small. So we're talking about, a relatively small amount of money from a town budget point of view. It's pennies. You know, these are nearly symbolic, efforts from the point of view of some of these towns. The money is so small on a town by town basis.
Let's talk about what happened in the one community so far that has rejected this proposal. This was Old Tappan, is that right?
Yeah, Old Tappan is how they
Old
pronounce
Tappan.
It.
Okay.
Old Tappan. Yeah, we've got this passed in 60 towns. We presented it to nearly 50 towns in nearly all 21 counties across the state. So it's in some level moving in some fashion in a big swath of the state of New Jersey. And we don't expect the perfect batting average, right? We're never going to – you can't approach these things with the assumption that, you're going to win in every single instance. You know, we just have to continue to work hard, continue to get our message out there, and continue to fight for it. And we're proving that it's a way that we can win behind enemy lines on this issue. So, hopefully – I would hope that this ultimately – starts to get exported to other states. And we've seen some small examples of that. A county in Virginia essentially copied our solution. And I think that's fantastic. But again, are we going to win in every single circumstance? It'd be unreasonable to think that. But, the situation in Old Tappan was a little bit frustrating because, it certainly appeared that there was broad support in some of the earlier sessions. And, I myself went to one of those council meetings and they had me sort of up there and sort of in front of the dais for over an hour, and we had a pretty good dialogue about it. And there seemed to be, at least some genuine sort of thought and consideration coming from that council. But politics is politics. And we've got to call it out when, quite frankly, when Republicans behave badly. I think that's the bottom line here.
Well, absolutely. And you had council members who were saying, like, what's the big deal? $200. That's not that unreasonable. We're talking again about the exercise of a fundamental right. $200, in my mind, a penny is unreasonable. But certainly right. $200. I mean, listen, that's a week's worth of groceries for a family. That's a month's electric bill. That's, if $200 is no big deal to you, man, I'd love to be living your life. $200 is a big deal to me. And so that argument was frustrating to hear. But also, it was frustrating to hear the argument of like, well, what's the big deal, right? I mean, we got permits to hold parades. You got permits to hold the garage sales. So what's the big deal about having a permit to carry? And what's the big deal about the government charging a fee? I guess the one good thing is that you're right. You're not going to bat 1,000. And this, if nothing else, this was an opportunity to hear, all right, well, what are the arguments that are going to be made against this? Right. What are people going to say? Even in, supposedly friendly areas, what's your counter to that, Joe, to these politicians who say, look, it's $200. It's not a lot of money, not a big deal, not a huge imposition. And you know what? I mean, hey, we're putting in the work to help approve this permit. So we're entitled to that $150.
Yeah, I mean, one, there's a couple of counter arguments that we're commonly making here. They'll raise that issue of, well, there's administrative cost to that. Well, let's look at Old Tappan for an example. There are 19 concealed carry permits in circulation in the residents of Old Tappan right now. So their municipal police department is essentially a fixed cost. They've got, X number of police officers. Some of them are involved in different activities. But the bottom line is that you're not increasing or decreasing your payroll or headcount because a police officer's got to push a button 19 times every 2 years, right? That's just simply not a thing. Your costs are fixed. There is no administrative cost. The state provides the plumbing for the concealed carry permit application process here. So all of the sort of nuts and bolts, the actual processing of the background checks, all administered by the state through a system that they maintain, that they pay. And quite frankly, they are not paying for that system through the permit fee either. They're charging a separate administrative fee for the application, about $20 every time you apply. And that's what pays for the actual background check system. So there's no internal cost to this. There's that argument that the reality is that there is no real expense to this. And then the flip side is, you know, no, $150 is a meaningful infringement on a core constitutional right. You brought up poll taxes earlier. You know, 1966 at Harper v. Virginia, the Supreme Court said that a $1.50 poll tax is unequivocal discrimination and a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Okay, that was 1966. Inflate that to today. That's about $14. So the Supreme Court drew a line in the sand. It said $14, that's absolutely discriminatory. $150 on a core constitutional right. Bruin stands for the principle, in addition to many things, that the Second Amendment is not a second class right. You know, so just on principle alone, you know, that sort of stands. But then there's this sort of nefarious reality in New Jersey, right? There's this cost prohibitive system. There's all the rigmarole that goes through that, the complexity of the application, the requirement for training. And then add to that the frustration that a lot of folks feel with things like permitting denials, where we're seeing these, you know, sort of widely disparate outcomes in terms of, you know, black and brown applicants versus white applicants. You know, again, it's a system that's designed to frustrate. Pair that with the fact that we have something in New Jersey called the Graves Act, which since 2008 has been brought into apply to the act of simple possession. So in other words, if you are caught in the state of New Jersey committing a crime with a firearm, and that crime is now limited down to just the simple act of possessing a firearm without the prescribed government permission slips, mandatory second degree charge, mandatory 42 months in prison, no expungement possibility, and you wear that like a scarlet letter for the rest of your life. So if we take poor communities in the state of New Jersey and absolutely hide a core right behind a paywall, allowing no one to get through, and then at the same time, when that person makes a hard choice living in a dangerous neighborhood, we throw them in jail for 42 months and then, you know, brand them with the scarlet letter for the rest of their lives. Justice Sotomayor called that civil death. And that's what we're doing in this state. It's horrific.
It is.
Everyone should agree.
You know, and I just, we were talking with Jacob Sullum from Reason Magazine yesterday. He's got a new book out called Under Control, which takes a look at the war on drugs, the war on guns, sort of the commonalities between the two. And, you know, again, if you told Democrats, hey, you know, we're going to have that exact same system for anybody caught in illegal possession of cocaine, mandatory minimum 42 month sentence, right? They lose their minds. That's completely unfair. It's, you know, it's a mistake. You got to help people. Okay, well, what's the difference? Except that one is that actual enumerated right, right? And the other is not. But you're telling me that somebody, again, who lives in a bad neighborhood, who wants a firearm to protect themselves, who does not, who cannot afford the $200 fee, maybe doesn't have transportation, maybe can't get to a range to undergo the training, right? I mean, all of these barriers to entry, if you are on the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder, but for whatever reason, they've got no nefarious intent, they're not caught robbing a bank or a corner store, they're just caught carrying a firearm. How is that fair to subject that individual to 42 months behind bars, to saddle them with a felony record for the rest of their lives, again, a non-expungible record, right? That because that's going to have an impact once they get out of prison. That's going to impact their ability to get a job. It's going to impact their ability to provide for themselves and their family. It may end up making it to the point where they feel like they've got no other option except to commit crimes to put food on the table.
Well, and that's exactly right. If you look at studies here, recidivism rates are something like 70% higher when the starting point crime involved a firearm. Because as you mentioned, you know, like if we did the same thing in the context of, let's say, a narcotics arrest, we frankly did that. That was the 1994 crime bill. And we saw the consequences of that. And we had both President Clinton and President Biden basically say, oh, man, we really messed up. I'm really sorry about that. Now, they ultimately didn't do anything about it, but they recognized that that was a horrific policy. But if again,
and the Democrats have doubled down on it when it comes to guns, particularly in New Jersey.
They've completely doubled down on it, even though we see the same impact, right? The recidivism rates are higher because those people cannot get out from underneath the initial charge. They carry it for the rest of their lives. As you say, unemployable, can't get an apartment. What choice do you have at that point?
Yeah.
You know, this is civil rights. This is not about the Second Amendment. You know, I really think towns are missing the point if they're getting the voting wrong on this measure. You know, that's exactly what we're talking about here. And there should be no disagreement.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what the reaction is when you make that argument to a city council that is Democrat majority. I imagine it's going to leave them very perplexed. Hopefully they're going to be, you know, intellectually honest enough to acknowledge that, you know, what you're saying makes sense. And you're absolutely right. I don't know that that's going to be the case, but we'll have to have you back on in the future to talk about this more. And in the meantime, you know, I'll obviously, as you mentioned, there's a sheriff in Virginia who has taken this and sort of run with it. So, you know, I would encourage gun owners in every state to talk to their own local officials about this. But specifically for Garden State gun owners, what can they do to help this ball keep moving forward?
Yeah, so it's real simple. We've got a section on our website, njfos.org. If you go to the section that says Take Action, we've created a real simple policy brief that explains the entire thing, and then a model resolution. You can simply download that document, contact your town council, send it to them, and say, we want to bring the same measure into our town. It really is that simple. You know, folks have been asking a lot, like, how do I do this? How can we get this done in my town? It's that simple. You have elected these people. You're one of their constituents. They need to hear from you. You just make your voice heard, and we move it from there.
Well, Joe, again, man, I really appreciate you spending some time with us today, and I look forward to having you back again very soon. Thank you again for everything that you're doing.
No, thank you, Cam, and thanks for giving us an opportunity to share about this, because I think it's important.
Anytime. Joe LaPorta with the New Jersey Firearm Owner Syndicate joining us here on Barry and Arms, Cam & Company.
Thank you, Cam.
My thanks to Joe for joining me on the program, and looking forward to having him back again in the very near future. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, which comes from New Mexico. You know, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has been very vocal about blaming lawful gun owners for violent crime, right? I mean, she has said in the past year or so, she started to make noise about, oh, we need to get tough on criminals. But she also wants to really crack down on legal gun ownership, too. I don't disagree that we do need to get tough on criminals. In fact, one of the issues where New Mexico really is lacking right now is its juvenile justice program, which is just, it's broken. It's just a broken system. There's no other phrase for it. And here's the headline. Teen accused of serious gun and drug crimes receives probation. Yes, indeed, in the juvenile justice system. This is from KOB in Albuquerque. And they report guns, fentanyl pills, thousands of dollars in cash. That's what investigators found on a local teenager multiple times in the past year. And now there are serious questions about whether his punishment fits the crime. The 17-year-old sentenced to 2 years probation on Wednesday, despite a prosecutor asking for 2 years in juvenile detention. And this relates to three different cases. First one in July of last year, Albuquerque police found multiple firearms, fentanyl, and $6,000 cash in the teenager's car. 2 months later, he ends up fleeing from a traffic stop, blowing through red lights, running stop signs, passing people on the shoulder, eventually ditches the vehicle, takes off on foot. When police searched the car, they found more than 6,000, or actually almost 6,000 fentanyl pills, as well as various gun parts. And then 3 weeks after that, by the way, they didn't catch the teen at the time. But 3 weeks later, Bernalillo County Sheriff's deputies did get a hold of him. Once again, he sped away from police, ended up crashing into a deputy's vehicle, and once again had drugs and guns in his possession when he was arrested. He spent, according to KOB, several weeks in a juvenile detention center and then was released to go to a drug treatment facility. Now, I don't know what several means, but it wasn't long, apparently. And the prosecutor said, since the respondent complied with the treatment afterwards, stayed out of trouble to this point, that it showed his willingness to engage and that he had a family willing to support him, that it would balance out the harm that was done. Now, she still sought a sentence, again, of 2 years in juvenile custody, which is the maximum that he could have served under the state's children's code. But instead, the judge sentenced him to 2 years probation. You know, and again, I'll name drop Jacob Solomon once again. As we talked about yesterday, right? I mean, possessory offenses, and that's what these were. 17-year-old wasn't charged with committing armed robbery, wasn't charged with home invasion, charged with possessing drugs and guns. At the same time, he's 17, he was not possessing a personal amount of narcotics. If you've got 6,000 pills, and that's for you alone, you got a serious problem. So that was an amount that was large enough. The prosecutor said, I mean, if he'd been, even a month or two later, well, at least when he turned 18, if this case had been referred to the federal judiciary, he could have been looking at spending most of the rest of his life behind bars. And instead he gets 2 years probation. Now, I don't think a life sentence would be appropriate in this case. Again, we are talking about a 17-year-old. But the 2 years of, you know, juvenile detention that the prosecutor is asking for, I think is eminently reasonable. Because even if this kid has undergone and was successful in his drug treatment program, even if he has a family that supports him, there have to be consequences for bad decisions like this. And I am concerned that the sentence that is handed down sends the message to both this individual and others out there that, again, if you're a juvenile, no big deal, right? You can get away with all kinds of stuff, and you don't really have to worry about the consequences, at least not from a legal perspective. At a time, again, in which violent crime is still really high in New Mexico, and it's supposedly dropping across most of the country, I think that's the wrong message to send. And instead of, again, looking to criminalize our right to keep and bear arms, I suggest that New Mexico lawmakers, when they get back to the roundhouse in Santa Fe, overhaul the state's children's code, overhaul the juvenile justice system, and ensure that individuals like this do actually receive some consequences. Again, not saying he has to spend the rest of his life behind bars, but more than 2 years probation, I think, is necessary here. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. Now, this is a wild one, I got to tell you. Here's the headline. Woman shot and killed after allegedly forcing entry into the home of her husband's girlfriend in Nashville. There's a lot to unpack there. All right, so this happened early Monday morning. Police say that 42-year-old Kiana Wilson died after being shot inside a home on Scalf Drive. She allegedly went to that home looking for her husband, who police say was in a dating relationship with the homeowner there. I'm not going to name her. Local media has, but she's not been charged with a crime. At this point, it sounds like she was a victim of a crime. So I'm not going to name her, even though her name is out there. Police say that when Kiana Wilson went to that home, she saw her husband's car behind the house. She apparently had his copy of, you know, the key to the car. So she ended up moving the car to the front of the house, I guess, just to let them know, hi, I'm here, right? Then she went up to the front door and began banging on the door, dinging the intercom. After some time, the alleged mistress started speaking to Wilson through the surveillance system speaker. They both began arguing about whether or not Wilson's husband was inside. According to police, Wilson attempted to forcibly enter the home, which is when the homeowner fired one shot that hit the storm door, did not strike Wilson at that point. Now, that would have been a really good opportunity for Wilson to say, okay, I'm going about this the wrong way. I'm waiting for my husband at home. I'm going to go cool off somewhere. Maybe I'm even going to go call police and say somebody shot at me. Nope, she didn't do that. According to police, she then actually did break into the home, and the two women began to fight. At some point, a second shot was fired by the homeowner, striking Wilson in the abdomen. That's when Wilson left the home. She got into her husband's car, drove a short distance away until she was able to flag down an officer. She was taken to a local hospital where she later passed away. The Nashville Police Department said after consultation with the district attorney's office, no charges were placed at this time. A determination of possible charges will be made after further investigation. Based on just the police report here, I don't think any charges will be warranted. You've got somebody who, while maybe engaged in behavior that we would consider to be unseemly, and I don't even know. I mean, maybe there's a statute against participating in adultery in Tennessee. I don't know. But regardless of that, you don't give up your right to self-defense just because you're involved with somebody's husband. And you have a right to be secure in your person and property. When somebody breaks through the door of your home and begins fighting you, You have the right to protect and defend yourself. When somebody breaks through the door of your home after you fired a shot at them, I would say that you have reasonable belief that individual intends to do you harm. So the circumstances, again, are bizarre. But in fact, this is the first defensive gun use like this I can recall in 20 plus years of reporting on them. But it does sound like this was a justifiable use of force. Maybe the shooting is self-defensible. I don't know about the personal actions, but that's a topic for a different podcast. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. These two are heroes, Good Samaritans saving a toddler and a baby from a deadly Detroit fire. Fox 2 in Detroit reporting that this was on Tuesday when these Good Samaritans came to the aid of these children. Unfortunately, one individual did die in what turned out to be the first of two fatal fire incidents in Detroit that day. As Fox 2 reports, the blaze broke out on a home on San Juan Street. People saw what was going on. They started calling for crowbars. They flagged down drivers. Several of them entered the structure. One of them was a gentleman named TJ Davis. He said, when I kicked in the door, it was full of smoke, thick black smoke. He said he crawled through the room, found a toddler on the floor, and was able to rescue him. Angela Boone, who also lives nearby, says he went in and got that baby and brought that baby out. She said that baby was laying on the ground, wasn't breathing at first. And then the baby started breathing. The neighbor came over and she kept pushing on the baby. Boone was able to take custody of another child who was actually passed out through a window. Jay Goody, who's another neighbor, said, you know, it's about saving people. He said, these two are heroes, the two who entered the home, saved those children. He said, I just came running out. I didn't know what was going on. But he talked again about Boone and Davis, calling them the, quote, real heroes, he said. The children's grandmother, unfortunately, passed away in that fire. The toddler that was rescued, there was another teenager who apparently was able to get out of the home on their own, who are in critical condition. Three other people being treated for smoke inhalation, including the infant that was passed out of the window to Boone. And, you know, again, I mean, this was bad enough, but it could have been so much worse were it not for those individuals who got involved, who before the fire trucks even arrived, on their own accord, put their own lives on the line to go into that burning home and rescue the individuals inside. So TJ Davis, Angela Boone, and the other Good Samaritans who went above and beyond to save the lives of others, we thank you for your very, very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm going to be off next week. So I will see you not next Monday, the following Monday. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com, though, in my absence. Tom Knighton is going to be covering all of the latest segment of news and information. Probably hear from John Petrolino, maybe some other folks as well. I may even contribute a story or two. In fact, I'll be writing up through the weekend and through Labor Day. So, yeah, you'll see some more output from me at the website. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.